I am finite, as we all are, and yet here we find ourselves this morning as finite beings attempting to describe an infinite being. There's nothing so humbling as realizing that my job is to tell you how great Jesus is, and my vocabulary is far too limited to do that. So let's take a look at Genesis. We're near the end of our series. We're going to see what Jacob on his deathbed has to say about this future king who would one day come from his son. Genesis chapter 49. We're going to begin reading in verse 1. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father." Now last week we saw that Jacob was so sick he couldn't walk anymore. He hadn't been able to walk for quite some time. Joseph found out that he was near death. Joseph traveled to see him. While he was there, Jacob adopted Joseph's two oldest sons, makes them heirs equal with his other children. This text picks up right after that. What we see here is Jacob has called together all of his sons, and he calls them for a specific reason. He says that he is going to tell them what shall happen in days to come. Now, this is significant in a couple of ways. First, he's doing this publicly. If you recall, it was his father who called together one of his sons. Remember, Isaac wanted to bless Esau, give Esau the birthright. Jacob found out about it, colluded with his mom. They tricked Isaac into giving Jacob the blessing. Jacob's not going to make that mistake. Jacob is going to pronounce the blessing to all 12 of his sons publicly. This is not going to be a secret thing. But it's significant in another way. That phrase, when he says that he's going to tell them what shall happen in days to come, is more than just a pronouncement. That phrase occurs several times in the Old Testament, and most of those occur in books of prophecy. Jacob isn't simply going to pronounce blessing on them. He is going to prophetically pronounce blessing on them. That is, Jacob is going to bless them by telling them a bit of their distant future. This isn't just Jacob making something up. This is God speaking through Jacob. Jacob is a patriarch. God is speaking through him as a prophet. Now, these prophecies aren't for the next day, the next month, the next year, even 100 years. Jacob knows that his offspring, his sons, are going to remain in Egypt, and they're going to be there for more than 400 years. He's talking about the distant future for them, long after they are one day taken out of Egypt. So what he says is extremely important. This affects all of them, and he wants them to pay attention. Now, he's going to address each son. He's going to do it mostly in order. We're actually going to jump around in the text a bit. But let's start with Reuben, Jacob's firstborn son, Reuben. Verse 3. Jacob says, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the firstfruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." Now, he addresses Reuben directly, right? This is in the second verse. He's saying you. He's talking directly to Reuben in front of all of his brothers. Now, he's praising Reuben, right? Reuben is Israel's firstborn. He's an example of how great Jacob is. I mean, Israel was still a young man just entering his prime when Reuben was born. He's the symbol of Jacob's strength and power. This is a great position of privilege for Reuben. As firstborn, Reuben should become the head of the nation that is forming in Egypt, the nation of Israel. I mean, when people think of Israel the man, they should immediately think of Reuben, his firstborn son, the one who takes over the nation after Jacob is gone. So imagine Reuben standing there in front of all of his brothers, and dad is praising him, preeminent in power, preeminent in dignity. Stands a little taller, puffs his chest out a little bit. He's looking around at the brothers. Yeah. But imagine what happens to him as dad keeps talking. He says great things about him. "You're firstborn, you're a symbol of my power, first in dignity, greatest in power." He's got to be like, "Oh, here it comes. What do I get for being all this?" "Reuben, you're as unstable as water. And because you're as unstable as water, you will not have the position that is preeminent among your brothers. You're not the firstborn anymore. You're the one born first, but you have not inherited the birthright." See, Jacob gives a real reason. This is the first time in the book of Genesis that Jacob actually addresses Reuben's sin against Jacob. He says, "You went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it." If you recall the story, Jacob had a concubine. Reuben, as firstborn, thought he would assert his authority, and he slept with dad's concubine. It was meant to be a power play on his part, demonstrating his authority to do whatever he wanted to do, since he was firstborn. He was the one who's going to take over the clan. That's not how Jacob saw it. Now you can see his disgust with Reuben because he switches from second person to third person. He's talking to Reuben, "You shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Can you believe it?" He's disgusted. He can't. His son, his firstborn son, the one who's supposed to rule in his place, defiled his own bed. The fact is, a person's sins will be found out. There's no way they can be kept hidden forever. But his brothers aren't exempt from this. Now, their sins were very public. He moves on to Simeon and Levi in verse 5. It says, "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul not come into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men. And in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Now, whereas Reuben is controlled by his lust, primarily out of a lust for power, Simeon and Levi are controlled by violence. If you recall the story, when their sister was attacked, rather than go after the perpetrator, they willingly slaughtered an entire city. They went into the city and killed all of the men because one man did something wrong. But it wasn't just that they killed all these men. Jacob says they're far more petty than just that. They hamstrung oxen. That is, they went behind oxen and cut their legs, the back of their legs, so they couldn't do any work. That's pointless. There's no value in doing this. It's just cruelty, and it is petty. And Jacob calls them on it. Look at the end of verse 7. He says, "I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Now, hundreds of years later, when the nation is, there's 600,000 men 400 years after this, plus women and children. When that nation enters into the promised land, each tribe is given an inheritance. Joseph gets a double inheritance. He gets the legal position of firstborn, the birthright. His sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, each get an equal portion. But they're all given territory within the promised land. Simeon's territory was completely inside of Judah's territory. In fact, by the time you get to the Song of Deborah Chronicles chapter 5, I believe it is. In the book of Judges, it's that early. Within a couple hundred years, Simeon ceases to exist as a distinct nation, as a distinct tribe within Israel. They become absorbed by the greater tribe, the tribe of Judah. Deborah does not mention that tribe in her song. It's quite probable that within 200 years of entering into the promised land, Simeon as a tribe has been scattered thoroughly and doesn't even exist as a distinct unit. But Jacob also says Levi will be scattered in Israel. Now, this prophecy is very interesting to me because it shows us how it is that God works in history. Levi was a partner with Simeon in attacking and slaughtering the city. And God is going to use that to scatter Levi in the promised land so that Levi also will not actually receive an inheritance. It is the tribe of Levi that will come to serve as priests for the nation of Israel. Since they serve as priests, they need to be everywhere in the land God promised them. So they're given 48 individual cities all over the promised land rather than their own distinct territory. That God uses the sin of Levi as the reason to scatter them in Israel. By scattering them, though, he's actually blessing the people. Because it was the priests who would offer the sacrifices necessary to cover the sins of the people so that they could be right with God. God is blessing them, and he's using the sin of Levi to do this. It's like God wanted Joseph in Egypt. And how did God get Joseph into Egypt? God used the sins of Joseph's brothers to get him there. The fact is, God uses means. God could work directly. God could work on his own. But most often, God uses the decisions and actions of people, right or wrong, right decisions or wrong decisions, right actions or wrong actions. God uses often the decisions and actions of people to accomplish his purposes. The fact is, God was always planning for the tribe of Levi to be scattered throughout Israel so that they could bless the other tribes. But there's another way God is going to bless all of Israel. Verse 22. Jacob says, "Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely, yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. by the God of your Father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessing of your Father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. Now we saw last week that Joseph is the one who inherits the birthright. As such, Joseph is the head of Israel at this point. He is the one who is truly preeminent in dignity, preeminent in power. He receives this double portion. In this prophetic pronouncement, Jacob is pronouncing blessing not only on Joseph, but on all of Israel. Because as Joseph, as the firstborn, is blessed, those blessings will flow to the rest of the people. As Joseph prospers, so the nation will prosper. However, not all of the blessings appear to be blessings. Some of them actually look a lot like not blessing. Look at verse 14. Issachar is a strong donkey crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites in the horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. Jump down to verse 19. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. Verse 27. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf in the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening dividing the spoil. Remember, this is a prophetic pronouncement from the patriarch, meaning that he is the mediator of God's blessing. This is prophetic. God is speaking through Jacob here. So imagine you're standing there, you're listening to these predictions of your family concerning the distant future, and over again you hear there's going to be war, there's going to be bloodshed, there's going to be oppression, there's going to be struggle, there's going to be fighting. Since this is prophecy, it's coming from the Lord, and since it's coming from the Lord, it's going to happen. There's no way this doesn't happen at some point in the future. It should come as no surprise that Jacob interjects a brief prayer into the middle of it, verse 18. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. In the midst of these depressing predictions, Jacob pauses to cry out to the Lord as the only one who can bring rescue. Now, surely the weight of the knowledge of the 400 years of oppression and affliction in slavery is already heavy on him. He knows what's going to happen to his sons after he is gone. And yet here he is predicting even more suffering after those 400 years. In the distant future, worse things are going to happen. It's going to be a time of incredible suffering and war and famine and all kinds of horrible things, difficulties are going to come about. Isn't it good news that God usually doesn't tell us our future? It's good news that we don't know what hardships are coming our way. I mean, if you knew the pain that you're going to experience ahead of time, that would be a truly frightening thing. I mean, who could handle that knowledge? You too would respond, God, help me. That's what Jacob is really crying out for. Now think of what he's prophesying. Issachar will be subjected to forced labor. What kind of future is that? Dan will be fierce in battle, which means he will have to hone his skills somehow. And the only way to hone your fighting skills is by fighting. Gad also will be fierce in battle. He's going to fight a lot. Dan is going to be fierce in battle. Benjamin is going to be dangerous. It's going to be a tribe not to be messed with. I mean, what father wants his sons to face a future of nothing but constant war? War isn't like the movies. It's far, far worse than the movies. No father wants that for his sons. And yet that's exactly what Jacob is predicting for many of his sons and for the offspring who will one day come from them. I mean, if God were to show you that you had financial trouble in your future, how would you respond? If God revealed to you that a terrible disease is headed your way, how would you respond to that? If God were to tell you that you are about to lose a loved one, how would you respond? If God were to show you that you're going to have a relationship that's going to fracture and break, how would you respond to that? If God were to reveal to you that somehow in the near future, you're going to be called into your boss's office, you're going to be handed a slip of paper that is not a bonus check, how would you respond? There's only one response. God, help me. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. In the midst of the troubles of this life, there's only one who can truly help us. And his name is God. There is only one Savior. Now, Jacob has no way of knowing how long his struggle or his offspring's struggle is going to be. He knows it's going to be 400 years into the future, at least. But he doesn't know how long it's going to last. Will Issachar be in forced labor for 10 years, 100 years, 1,000, 10,000 years? How long will Benjamin have to be fierce in battle before he can settle down and take it easy? He doesn't know. What Jacob doesn't seem to know also is who is going to end their troubles. Now, he knows what God is saying. God is speaking through him, but he doesn't fully understand it. Prophets often didn't understand all of the details that went into what God was saying. Look at his prophecy concerning Judah, verse 8. Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion, as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. Now, Judah is not the firstborn. He's actually the fourth. Joseph was granted that position as the one who received the birthright. But Judah was fourth, and yet Jacob is predicting a much greater future for Judah than he did even for Joseph. Judah will be victorious over his enemies. Now, surely the enemies of his brothers are his enemies, and so this is a promise for the rest of the clan. But that because Jacob or Judah would one day protect them, that indicates a reason for them bowing down to him. Now, think about that for a moment. Jacob says that Judah's brothers will bow down to him. Joseph is the one who had the dream where his brother bowed before him. And when the brothers went to Egypt, they found this Egyptian ruler, didn't know it was Joseph. They bowed before him, just as God promised Joseph in a dream. But here Jacob's predicting that tables are going to turn. Joseph is the one day going to bow down before Judah, as are all the sons of Jacob, all the tribes of Israel. There are reasons for this. Jacob says Judah will be fierce and shall be feared. He also says Benjamin's going to be fierce, and yet that's not a reason for the other tribes to bow before Benjamin. It's much more than that. There's the lion imagery, right? Lions are dangerous. A single man cannot face a lion in battle unless he has a gun. They didn't have guns back then. God has something more here for Judah, something far greater than just fierce and being fierce in battle. Verse 10, Jacob says, the scepter won't depart from Judah. Now, a scepter is a sign of royalty. It's that golden stick that kings would carry. You know what I'm talking about. Jacob is predicting that Judah's tribe will one day rule over the nation. He predicts incredible wealth that comes with this. I mean, when he says that Judah would bind his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, we all get what that means, right? That makes sense. Who in their right mind would tie their animal to their best grapevine? The best grapevine is the one that produces the best grapes. What happens when you tie a donkey to a grapevine? The donkey's going to eat the grapes. The only person who would do that is the person who had so many choice vines that he didn't care if the best ones got eaten because he's got a whole other field of it. It's kind of like a good steak, right? A good, yummy Kobe beef steak. You know, the kind the kind that people will pay $100 for in a swanky restaurant. Imagine feeding that to your dog. Here you go, a Ruth's Chris Steakhouse for you. You wouldn't do that. That's crazy. You don't take a dog to a chop house. Judah's wealth, though, will be so great that he'll feed expensive food to his animals and not think twice about it. Now, scholars nearly universally agree that this is prophetic, not simply of Judah, but more specifically, of the covenant that God would one day make with a man named David. David, of course, is from the tribe of Judah. He won't be born for another 1,000 years or so. God is going to make a covenant with him. God is going to promise him that one of David's descendants would be on his throne and would be on his throne forever. It would be a kingdom without end. It would never end. Now, if you know the story of Israel, then you remember that Saul was their first king. God would reject Saul as king, though, because Saul failed to obey God completely. David is then crowned king, and then God promises David this eternal kingdom. Now, this covenant he promised has a twofold fulfillment, just like Abraham's did, right? God promised Abraham, I'll give you a son, and God gave him a son. His name was Isaac. But he also meant, I'm going to give you a son in the distant future, and his name is Jesus. Jesus is the one who is going to fulfill the covenant with Abraham. Well, this covenant also has a twofold fulfillment. Now, in the near term, David had a son named Solomon. Solomon was probably the greatest king Israel ever had. God blessed Solomon, gave Solomon a great kingdom. It was a time of absolutely incredible prosperity. In fact, look at this depiction of wealth in Solomon's day. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon, that's his palace, were of pure gold. None were of silver. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. Go down to verse 27, the same chapter. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. Imagine you're living in Jerusalem when Solomon is king, and you're walking down the street one day, and you see a hunk of silver on the side of the road. You might kick it down the road as you're walking like you would a rock, but you wouldn't pick it up because, meh, it's too far. It's not worth it. It's just silver. I bet you Solomon fed his dogs Kobe beef, and I bet you he tied his donkeys up to a vine. He's from the tribe of Judah. He is experiencing this incredible wealth that God promised. What is truly amazing, though, is that the kingdom Solomon ruled over is but a mere shadow of the kingdom that is to come. You see, there is this near fulfillment. Solomon was placed on the throne, and the throne is an eternal throne, but there would be a man not sitting on it for a period of time, because God had to bring human history to such a point that he can bring the offspring of David, the promised son of David, who would rule over his kingdom. But despite this promise of a great kingdom, there were other problems that his people would continue to experience, problems you and I experience today. Verse 28. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with a blessing suitable to him. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Despite this promise of an eternal kingdom, death still reigns. Death still claims God's people. God's people die, and they are buried in the earth. God promised that the great king's promise to Abraham would come through specifically through the tribe of Judah. Yet Jacob will die. He already buried his wives. He buried his father and his mother. He himself is about to die and will be buried in the same cave. As great as God's promises were, they remained unfulfilled in Jacob's day. Remember the covenant with Abraham? The promise for a son? Jesus is the greatest fulfillment. We've seen that throughout the book of Genesis. Jesus is the greatest fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. Remember God's promise that David's son would rule? In the same way, Jesus is the greatest fulfillment of that promise. Here's how Peter explains it in Acts chapter 2, preaching on the day of Pentecost. Brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried. His tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption, that his son wouldn't rot in the grave. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. Peter says the resurrection of Jesus was his coronation. After resurrection, Jesus was elevated to his position as king. Peter directly ties God's promise of an eternal kingdom to the resurrection of Jesus. To say it another way, Jesus is the fulfillment of God's covenant with David. Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise that David would have a son who would reign on his throne forever, a kingdom without end. Fact is, God's covenant with David is the fulfillment of God's promise to Jacob about Judah. God keeps his promises. And yet Jacob pulled his legs up into his bed and died. God's people still die. God's people still get buried in the earth. God's people still wait for the fulfillment of all of God's promises. But that's why this chapter ought to give us hope. There is hope for a future. God promised that a ruler would come from Judah, so God brought about a man named David. God promised David that one of his sons would sit on his throne forever, and so God sent Jesus, his son. Because Jesus died, and because the promise was for an eternal throne, God had to raise him from the dead. You can't reign if you're dead. So God raised him from the dead, and when he raised him, placed him on David's throne. Yet we still die. But that's because God hasn't finished fulfilling his promises. Look at these words from 1 Corinthians. Paul says, "But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive, but each in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then at his coming those who belong to Christ. Then comes the end when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death." It says Christ is the first fruits of resurrection. Now, first fruits are the first bit of the harvest. If a farmer harvested his wheat crop, the very first wheat, if it's thin and scraggly and kind of sparse, first fruits aren't very good. The crop's not going to be very good that year. But if the first bit of wheat that he harvests is thick and dense and heavy, there's lots of it, it's going to be a good harvest that year. The first fruits told you what the rest of the harvest was going to be like. Jesus is the first fruits of the dead. What does that mean? That means the resurrection of Jesus shows us what our future holds, what it's like going to be like for us in the resurrection. All those who are... Oh, thank you so much. That's twice in a row. All those who are in Adam are going to die. That means all of us. Everyone is in Adam. All those who are in Christ, that is those who are following him, those who are trusting in him, all those will be made alive. They're going to be resurrected from the dead. Paul says that the order is simple. First, Christ was raised. And then when he comes back, everybody else gets raised. We know what our resurrection is going to be like. We know that we're going to be resurrected because Christ was resurrected. What happens next? Paul says, then comes the end. What is the end? The end is when Jesus has reigned and he has finally, once and for all, put all of his enemies under his feet. All of his enemies. That includes death. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. When Jesus was raised from the dead, his resurrection dealt death itself a mortal blow. Death is dying. It doesn't know it yet, but death itself is dying. And when Jesus comes back, it's going to be dead, dead. Completely dead. Not mostly dead, going to be dead, dead. Death is dying. Now, death still claims God's people, but death will die. The end is coming. Jesus is king, and the king will destroy all of his enemies. The last enemy the king will destroy is death. You see, not only is Jesus the kind of king who keeps his word, but Jesus is the eternal King of Kings, and so he has the power and the authority to actually keep it. Because Jesus is king, Jesus can declare that a thing will happen, and it happens. King Jesus makes a claim to all authority. And because he has all authority, that means there is none higher. There is no one who is more powerful. Look how Isaiah the prophet describes it in Isaiah 46. It says, "Remember this," this is God speaking, "remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, from ancient times, things not yet done. Saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. Calling a bird of prey from the east, a man of my counsel from a far country. I have spoken, and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed, and I will do it." That is a statement of raw sovereignty. There is no one who can stand opposed to God. Several years ago, in a Reformed journal, a woman, Virginia Stem Owens, said it this way, and I ran this by the elders, so if you're offended, sorry. Talk to them. "Let us get this one thing straight. God can do anything he damn well pleases, including damn well. And if it pleases him to damn, then it is done ipso facto, which means as a matter of course, it is done well. God's activity is what it is. There isn't anything else. Without it, there'd be no being, including human beings presuming to judge the creator of everything that is. God is God, and so he can do whatever he wants to do, and there's no one who can stop him, no one who can challenge him, no one who can hinder him, no one who can alter his path, no one who can slow him down, no one who can accelerate his plans. He's God. That means he's God and I'm not. He's God, and you are not. There is only one God. God's counsel shall stand, and God will accomplish his purpose. God has spoken, and God will bring it about. There's nothing you or anybody else, even combined, can do about it. There's only one God. You have to stand in awe of God like that, because there is nothing greater than God. Absolutely nothing greater than God. What we also need to recognize is that God, in his raw sovereignty, in his raw power, in his raw authority to do whatever he wants to do, God is good. God is good. God is kind and merciful. God offers forgiveness and grace to anyone who comes to him in humble faith. The King of Kings has been working since the foundation of the world to bring about cosmic restoration, the salvation of his people and of the world he created to be the place where he would be with his people forever. The God who can speak light into existence. The God who, with a flick of his divine wrist, casts galaxies into space, crossing distances so vast that not one of us can comprehend them. The God who simply wills things to happen and they happen. That God has willed to save many from their sins, to help people in their distress, to one day make all things right. Raw power, raw sovereignty, absolute goodness. When God created Adam and Eve, he was working to reveal the glory of his Son. When God sacrificed an animal to cover the sins of Adam and Eve, he was working to reveal the glory of his Son. When God called a man named Abram, who was an idolater, when God called him, God was working to reveal the glory of his Son. When God sent Joseph to prison in Egypt on false charges, God was working to reveal the glory of his Son. See, all of history points us to this, the glory of Jesus as the King of Kings. With divine power and authority, God has been working since the dawn of time to bring about the salvation of his people. God has moved entire nations around the earth to accomplish his purpose. Think of what that means for you and me. It means when your doctor gives you that report that you hoped you'd never hear, it means your God is sovereign. It only happens by his authority. It means that when you get that phone call that no parent or spouse ever wants to get, God is sovereign. It means that when your boss calls you into his office and hands you a slip of paper, your God is sovereign. It means that when you aren't sure how you're going to pay your bills, your God is sovereign. It means when you're on your deathbed and you know your offspring are going to spend 400 years in slavery and oppression, your God is sovereign. Many years ago, God spoke through a blind man on his deathbed, and he told of a time when one of his son's offspring in the far future, a king would come from Judah. That ruler has come. His name is Jesus, and he has come for salvation. He is the King of Kings, and he is reigning right now. Yet his kingdom is coming. There's still an aspect of it that is future, and yet he is reigning right now. One day his kingdom will cover the entire earth, but his kingdom is also now. See, it's one thing to look to God as a kind, benevolent king who provides for you and protects. That's true. He does that. He is that kind of king. We also need to recognize that he is a holy king. And since he is holy, and since he is king, then he must be king not only of nations, he must be king not only of galaxies and, you know, throughout the entire universe, he must be king of you over your life. Jesus is king, and so as king, he is the one who determines how we ought to live. He is the one who determines what we ought to value, how we ought to spend our money, who we ought to spend our time with, what kind of job we ought to work. We look to Christ for salvation and for protection and for rescue, but we also look to Christ as our sovereign king who rules over our day-to-day lives. See, every day we ought to live for the glory of this great king. We ought to live for his glory. And the way that we live for his glory is by making his glory the primary motivator in everything that we do. We make the determination, not what would Jesus do, but what would make Jesus look good. That's how I'm going to choose to spend my money. That's how I'm going to choose to spend my time. That's how I'm going to choose my words. What makes Jesus look good? Because he is all beautiful. And because he's all beautiful, I want people to know that. I want people to see true beauty. That's how we live for his glory. Our great God and King has come to rescue us, and he is going to be with us forever. This rescue includes this future world, right? He's coming back, as we saw last week. He's going to recreate the heavens and the earth. That's been our benediction for the last year. We're going to see God, he's coming. He's going to recreate it. All the bad stuff's going to come undone. And God is going to, this earth is going to be the temple where God will dwell with his people forever. That's what the imagery at the end of Revelation means. God is going to live on this planet with his people, and we're going to see Jesus in his full glory. Everyone on earth, all of his people, will recognize who he is. We will praise and worship him together. That day's coming, but that day's also today. We, as his people, must live under the authority of King Jesus. We must live our lives in such a way as to make our beautiful king known, to expand his kingdom. Just as Adam was to expand the garden, we must expand his kingdom. We do that by living for him, by telling others about him. What a great God we serve. What a great king we serve. Our goal ought to be to make him known.